From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
And this is really one of our favorite annual traditions, Rochester's Favorite Books 2019 edition. The shorthand is Rochester's Favorite Books, but it has come to be more than that. We tell people that are invited on the program for this two-hour show, you can choose anything you want that you read this year, anything that stood out that is memorable, meaningful. These are books that are either just their favorite pure read for pleasure, or maybe something profound that stands out to them. A great list of people from across our community. And you just heard a great hour. We've got the second hour ready to go here.
That's right. And get a pen and paper ready, because if you're looking for a reading list for 2020, now's a great time to start compiling that. We have books that will make you laugh, make you cry, make you think. And our guests are ready to tell you all about them. So let's get started.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2019, and our next guest is a commissioner on the Rochester City School Board, and that is Natalie Shepherd, who is with us to tell us about one book that stood out to you this year.
Yeah, so as you guys know, I do a lot of reading for the district, but in my spare time, I do get a chance to read other books. And the one that has really touched my spirit this year is titled Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues, and by the author Dante Worth.
Dante has been on this program, and an extraordinary personality, and frankly, just sort of infectious.
Yeah.
But this is the first time I've had a chance to pick up the book and see it. Why did it move you?
It moved me because many people know in my daytime job, I am a juvenile justice. I'm a licensed master social worker. And so I deal with youth who have been impacted by certain traumas throughout their life that they just had no control over. I say a lot that, you know, kids shouldn't have to worry about doing anything or being anything but themselves and being a child. And a lot of times in the field that I work in, you see that youth are going through very difficult situations that even adults wouldn't be able to really cope with in an effective way. And so this book is an autobiography that Dante wrote about some of the situations that he had to endure during his childhood. And the reason why it touched me is because it's a hard read. It talks about some of the traumatic events that he had to live through, and just seeing how he internalized that trauma, it really spoke to me, and it really made me understand that this is an issue I don't think people really grasp what our kids go through. So one of the quotes that he had in his book, he said, dealing with internal issues, I was bound by my own perceptions and incarcerated by fear. And he just talks about how he tried as a youth, you know, just not being on the earth years enough to have gone through enough experiences to really build up coping skills. And he just talked about how that internalized in his actions. And so as an adult, I did want to read one excerpt from his book.
Yeah, please do.
He says, someone once said, how you respond to adversity determines your strength. For several years, my strength was small, and I often felt inferior to those around me who appeared to be normal. It's just hair. It's just hair. That's what everyone else kept telling me, but the issue was bigger than the absence of hair. My identity, my emotional well-being, and my social life were all being impacted by an issue that I had no control over. For many years, I felt so alone inside. I hadn't ever met anyone who was living with the same issue, and it left me feeling even more misunderstood. The loss of hair may have been only the physical effect of the condition, but inside I felt so different. And so I deal with so many youth who go through different experiences in their life where they do feel alone. And it breaks my heart, because as the professional, I sit there and I listen and I'm just like, but you're not alone, because there's so many different people who go through these things, and it doesn't make it okay. But you try to, as an adult, kind of guide and navigate youth to really feeling empowered to live through their circumstances and not allow their issues to be who they are, which is what this book talks about with Dante.
He's obviously very straightforward.
Yes.
About what he's dealt with. I don't remember the name of his condition, but he's certainly not the only one who has had a condition that basically you live with all of the hair in your body falling
Yes.
out. He's also, when you meet him now, He's a good-looking man.
Absolutely.
He cuts a good suit.
Yes, yes.
And he's, I said, infectious and upbeat, and that's why I think the book probably has an even more powerful hold, considering that he didn't always have this confidence and this sort of outgoing positivity.
Yes, that's right. And his condition is called alopecia. And even with that, he talks about other situations that he has had to endure, which has made him the person that he is today. And when I say that this is a hard read, I do think that it's worthwhile for people to understand that these narratives are real. These are real life experiences. So when you see particularly youth, you see that they externalize some of the things that they're going through because they just don't know any other way to get attention. And this kind of gives you that perspective that to sit back and say, whoa, what is it that's happening on the inside that's making you act like this on the outside? And sometimes all it takes is just a question. You know, Dante talks about some adults in his life who they just ask what is going on with you, and that made the world of a difference for him to just be able to vent to somebody.
All right, so the name of the book and the author one more time.
The name of the book is Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues, and the author is Dante Wirth.
Commissioner Shepherd, Happy New Year. I know we'll talk much more in 2020.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Evan.
Our next guest is Andrew Brady, CEO of the Accelerate Team and co-founder and chair of Conscious Capitalism Rochester. Andrew, nice to see you for our annual book show.
I'm really excited. Thanks for the invitation.
I can't believe we haven't had you on this before.
I've been on the show a few times, but now I'm excited to share a little bit of what we've been working on with Conscious Capitalism because it kind of ties into the book that I picked.
Perfect. So tell us the title and the author of your book.
So it's called The Healing Organization by Raj Sisodia and Michael Gelb. And Raj is actually the gentleman who wrote a lot of the books that started the whole Conscious Capitalism movement. The first one was called Firms of Endearment and had a lot of great case studies of some of these businesses that have been, you know, going above and beyond in terms of what they offer for their employees and for the community. But this is sort of the next evolution of conscious capitalism, because especially in the current environment and some of the rhetoric that's going on around in terms of, you know, what business and capitalism is or isn't and what it can or can't achieve for our society, this is really kind of as the sustainability movement really started with how do we do a little bit less harm, and now it's more how do we have, you know, a positive impact on the environment. This is similar with the Healing Organization in terms of, you know, maybe conscious capitalism or corporate social responsibility started with how do we do a little bit less harm or a little bit less hurting of the environment or our employees or our communities. And now it's really how do we have companies as a source of healing for the people that work there, the people that shop there, the people that are in the surrounding community.
I know you probably don't want to give too much away regarding what you read, but what's an example of a company that you think, either from the book or that you've seen in all of your work, that's doing this really well?
Yeah, so one example is Grayston Bakery. So they're actually mentioned in the book, but we also have in Rochester a local pilot of what Grayston calls open hiring. So Grayston, for the last 35 years, they have been doing this crazy thing called open hiring where there's no interviews, no background checks, no drug tests. You basically put your name on a waiting list, and when it gets to the top, you're hired. And you may have never had Grayston, or you may have never heard of Grayston before, but if you look, you can see, if you've ever had Ben & Jerry's ice cream, you can actually see that Ben & Jerry's ice cream, anything that has brownies in it, you've eaten some Grayston products. So Grayston Bakery, they say, we don't hire people to bake brownies, we bake brownies to hire people. And so they're really trying to, you know, because they can hire this population that maybe they have criminal records, maybe they have a history of mental illness or drug addiction. You know, there's obviously, other than just giving this person a job, there's a lot of support services that need to surround and support that person ability to keep the job. And so they have been doing this for so long that they're like, gosh, how can we start to expand this model and teach it to other organizations? And so there's a company here locally called CleanCraft. They do commercial cleaning, and they've actually signed on to be the first pilot outside of Yonkers, New York, where Grayston started, to actually try this here in Rochester for open hiring.
How's it going so far? Have you heard much?
So they are kind of in a soft opening phase right now where they're getting ready, and in the next few months they'll have a grand opening to really announce it, hopefully after, you know, ironing out the kinks and really getting an understanding of how the model needs to adapt and evolve for Rochester and just understanding the ecosystem in Rochester. But this healing organization, I think it's really important because it talks about They use a great metaphor of a lot of people when they're trying to do corporate social responsibility. They want to make a big wave. They want to make a big splash and, you know, be able to do a lot of the marketing around it, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But how do we instead not just look at the big wave, but change the underlying currents? And that's something that's really powerful, because business really has to be a part of that change. Not the savior, but really can have a much more positive impact than it's having now.
Going back to the open hiring situation, what would you say to someone who may say, how can you hire someone without even having an interview, without even talking to them beforehand, regardless of their background? You know, it could be the population that you described. It could be, you know, you, for example. How would you talk to someone who would say, I have to talk to someone before I bring them in for a job? I have to have information. I have to have a sit-down conversation.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the statistics on how bad we are, based on resumes, based on interviews, based on some of the traditional methodologies of actually picking the right employee. But beyond that, you know, maybe in your organization, you couldn't, like Grayston does, you couldn't hire everyone from this open hiring model. But that's actually one of the things that they're working on here in the pilot, is there's probably in your organization maybe two or three or four jobs where you could, where it's not a ton of training or some kind of certification that's required. And so what they're doing with this pilot is, if we have a few people that can be that central hub, because it's, you know, difficult to provide all those support services if you're only hiring a few jobs. But if we have a centralized hub for all of that coordination, then what if we could get 100 companies in Rochester to hire three or four jobs in this more open hiring methodology? It could really start to make an impact.
If you're picking up this book and you're not a manager, you're not in the role of a supervisor, what tips can you take away if you're, you know, just a regular employee, but you want to make your organization a better one?
I think one of the things that struck me was they talk about, if you think or look back into history, they talk about the different emperors and those emperors who were named, you know, Alexander the Great or whatever the Great. They say usually the Great comes from causing great suffering, you know, and instead, what if we didn't have this idea of the leader that had to be the hero and had to be the conqueror? And I'd say for just whether it's a leader or whether it's an everyday employee or somewhere in between, be wary of the language that you're using, because oftentimes we do use that conquering type of language when we're, you know, beating down our competitors or all of these different elements that we use. And that kind of mindset really starts to infiltrate the way that we then deal with employees or the environment or the communities that we're a part of, that's a lot more in that conquering mentality rather than more of a collaborative and a healing approach.
Repeat the title and the author for us.
So this is The Healing Organization by Raj Sisodia and Michael Gelb. And Raj will actually be coming to town in May with Conscious Capitalism. So have a chance maybe to meet him and hear him talk.
And where can people learn about Conscious Capitalism?
ConsciousCapitalismROC.org for our local chapter, where we do monthly events. And then there's ConsciousCapitalism.org for the international movement.
Andrew Brady, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Happy New Year.
Too.
As we celebrate Rochester's favorite books 2019, our next guest is a little bit of a confession here. One of our favorite people in Rochester, Amanda Chestnut, is a veteran and a very highly regarded figure in the Rochester art scene. So it's nice to see you here.
It's good to be here. I really appreciate it.
Well, and we're reaching out to people across our community to find out what stood out among the books you read in 2019. Tell us about your choice.
My choice is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. It's a book of essays by David Sedaris.
Let's explore what with what?
Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. So it's a collection of essays, and many of them are written from his perspective, but several are written as characters that are kind of a caricature of people who he, as a person, might be in opposition to. So it was a really interesting read to read ideas and thoughts in Sedaris's voice, in his writing, but to have them be expressing things that you wouldn't typically find in his work.
What's your typical reading routine?
For me, I actually mostly read what's relevant to the work that I'm doing. I have dyslexia. And so when I spend a lot of time reading articles, research, work-related topics, I don't often have a lot of bandwidth left to read for pleasure. By the time I'm done getting the reading done for work, I'm just so exhausted by reading. There isn't a lot of energy left to read. So usually if I am reading for fun, it is something that is exceptionally compelling. It's something that's been kind of niggling at my brain. It's an idea that has been implanted and has been present for weeks or sometimes even months. And then I have to go and visit this book to help me flesh out and round out the whole idea.
Well, Sedaris is not only one of the highly regarded essayists of our time, but it's probably a great recommendation because people can consume it in chunks if they'd like. Is there anything in the book that in particular that stood out?
This book in particular I picked up in 2019 specifically because of the essay Laugh Kookaburra. It was a New Yorker essay, and it is the first instance in writing where we hear of the Four Burners Theory, which I don't know. Are you familiar with the Four Burners Theory?
Oh, man. Am I in trouble if I say no?
Not at all.
Okay.
No. The Four Burners Theory is that you are a stove. Picture a stove mm-hmm. with four burners. Gas or electric, doesn't matter. Each burner represents a portion of your life, your health, your family, your friends, and your finances, your job. And in order to be really successful, you have to turn off burners. If you want one flame to be really high and really hot, the stove only has so much energy. So you need to sacrifice energy in one of those four quadrants to increase the energy somewhere else. And for the longest time in my life, I was very... For several years of my life, I had read that and I was like, of course, this is perfect. Let's go. And I turned off my health burner and I turned off my friends burner and pushed ahead in work. And in 2019, revisiting that essay, I'm not entirely sure that Sedaris ever meant it to be an encouragement to engage in that kind of behavior. The Four Burners Theory holds still, but for me and also for many of my friends, 2019 was the year that everybody really struggled. It was a hard year for a lot of people, and revisiting the Four Burners and assessing how I am applying my energy to my friends and family and my health and how that impacts my career has been huge in my life this year. And so that's why this essay specifically came up and why I needed to come back to Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
What an interesting way of illustrating the energy sort of balance or imbalance we can have. And I guess everybody listening right now is thinking about how their four burners are distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with trying to have a balance, right? I mean, it would strike me that we probably feel pressure to pour as much as we possibly can into the job burner, you know, the career burner, but there is a cost to that.
Absolutely. There always is. And I think that it's more important to be aware of that cost than it is to be gung-ho and switch off your burners and go all in. I think that knowing that cost is equally as important as being willing to make that sacrifice. And sometimes we make the sacrifice without knowing the full breadth of what that cost can be until it's too late.
The name of that essay is?
Laugh Kookaburra.
Laugh Kookaburra. And the book is David Sedaris, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. How else would you explore diabetes? Amanda Chestnut, here's to, in 2020, feeling whatever balance of the burners you want.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks for being here.
Our next guest is Michael Galvin, the curator for the Seneca Art and Culture Center, and he's here to discuss his favorite book of the year, of course. Michael, nice to see you.
Good to see you too, Megan.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And what book did you choose?
It was a toss-up, but I settled on There, There by Tommy Orange.
Tell us a little bit about There, There. And it's a beautiful cover, by the way, if you can tell our listeners what you're looking at there. Beautiful orange book.
Yeah, it's a great hardcover, brilliant orange with some good sort of script on it. It's really appealing, but, you know, book covers are what they are. The contents are really amazing. And as far as I know, the author, Tommy Orange, this might be his debut novel. And it's great and refreshing because it's a contemporary, you know, it's contemporary fiction, but focusing on urban native people.
Tell us a little bit about the story.
Right. So he selected an area of the country which is lesser known as native country, which is the urban landscape. And, you know, in the United States, big urban centers like New York City and Los Angeles, San Francisco, those big towns, they have significant native populations. And they're long lived in places for native people, you know, as urban centers, you know, typically do attract people for work, and native people, you know, we do the same things. But the difference, I think, for native folks is that we sort of bond together, you know, in our shared heritage. And, you know, we have community centers and programming that supports our native community in the urban setting. And his characters he develops, you know, are just all these facets of Indianness. And that's really refreshing because there isn't a single way to be Native American today. There's like there's thousands of ways, and ranging from just having a you know, a genetic cultural, I mean, I would say a genetic connection to your Native identity, to, you know, being full participant in your community and your, you might say, your religion and culture too. So, but he sort of presents us with a lot of characters in this urban setting that run the gamut of, you know, being Native. It really speaks to our identity.
Is there one character that you follow throughout the novel, or does he tell different stories?
Yeah, he follows a number of different parallel narratives with different individuals, and they all kind of are on this path, which is, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but it's like a pathway to an impending, dangerous, devastating event. You know, it all culminates around an urban powwow in the Los Angeles area, and all these characters who you come to know and understand really well, they kind of all meet at one point where this thing happens, and it's really powerful.
I know you don't want to give too much away, but is there one character or one story that you yourself particularly identified with or followed more closely than the others? Something that really spoke to you?
Yeah, I'd rather not like point out a particular character, because I guess for me, being an urban Native American, I saw myself in a lot of the different characters. You know, I saw aspects of myself in a lot of them, and I don't think one in particular connected more than the others, but he just was really great at fashioning these people and filling them with content and emotion and their experience as Native people in an urban setting. It was just really refreshing to hear that kind of a story, particularly because, you know, the author is Native American. That's a part of his experience living in Southern California. And it's not a subject that people are typically exposed to. So, you know, if somebody's interested in Native folks and our experience as modern people in an urban setting, I mean, this book will really open some eyes.
We've talked a lot on the show about how Native American populations are represented in the media, in literature, and, you know, we've had some deep conversations about the caricatures that we often see. Do you think we're seeing more real stories as we move forward? Was 2019 a good year for literature, for media, in terms of how Native Americans are represented, in your view?
I mean, baby steps are really what we're seeing, I think, more and more. There's definitely an American cultural shift in that people are interested in getting things right, you know, and sort of setting the record straight and saying, you know, what is right and what is wrong, particularly to, you know, positions of power. And so I've seen an uptick in interest, you know, from like the school level to universities and even organizations, right? Companies are reaching out and wanting to understand, you know, what it is, what our experience is as Native people, and what do we see that needs to be changed. So I think in parallel with that, there'll be some probably advances. I think that you know, authors, literature, film, television will those sort of doors might be opening up a little bit more for us. I think in literature, you know, we really, as Native people, we're really proud of our, you know, acclaimed authors. And, you know, starting maybe in the modern era with Sherman Alexie, you know, and Adrian Lewis, these are authors that you should look up and read their books. But, you know, transitioning from author to, you know, we're putting on-screen versions of your stories, that, like, that makes us really happy, I would say, because we're just so poorly represented in the media. So this book, because it's great literature, you know, and great storytelling, I mean, probably will find its place, you know, among the great American authors, you know, and I really look forward to his next novel.
Michael Galvin, thank you so much. Tell us the title and author one more time.
The story is There, There by the author Tommy Orange.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Let's take our only break of the hour, and we're right back to hear more of Rochester's Favorite Books 2019. Next up, a colleague from City Newspaper.
Welcome back to Rochester and Western New York's Favorite Books 2019 edition. Our next guest is Rebecca Rafferty, the arts and entertainment editor at City Newspaper, our colleague here at WXXI. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for telling us about your favorite book of 2019.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what did you pick?
So I picked Samantha Hunt's book, Mr. Splitfoot.
I am loving the cover of this book. If you can describe it for our listeners who can't see it right now.
Yeah, this is actually what attracted me to it. I was hanging out at Writers and Books in the lobby just chatting with friends, and on their used shelves, I saw this bright orange book with this silhouette of a snake that has a forest winding through its coils.
Yeah.
So, and I picked it up and read the inner leaf of it and was super intrigued. So it's in the vein of other books that have explored the history and legacy of religious revivalism in Western New York and Central New York, very much in particular with the Fox Sisters, with the idea of fraudulent mediumship sort of thing.
Tell me a little bit about the plot itself. Who are we following throughout the book?
Okay, so it begins with two orphan teens who are about to age out of the system, and in particular, they're in the care of an abusive religious fanatic. So their form of escapism is to sort of act as mediums for the other children, allowing them to speak with their dead parents, basically. So it starts off pretty bleak. It's a very raw, bleak story. But by the end of it, it's this, like, absolutely gorgeous odyssey through Western New York all the way to Albany, basically, that is very, very full of hope and love.
Is Rochester mentioned at all throughout, or Western New York? What can you tell us specifically about places or people that our listeners might recognize?
That's one of the things that was really engaging, is that it's because it's set in Western New York, actually from suburbs. It starts off in the suburbs of Buffalo, and they trek, certain characters in the book trek from there over to, all the way to Albany along the Erie Canal. So it's very rooted in sort of rural areas, and there's so much that's very familiar. They do mention Rochester. They go into the history of industries, and there's a lot of familiar names in particular with businesses and locations and towns, but also just the really rich descriptions of this, the terrain and the area. It's extremely familiar.
Is this a subject that you gravitate toward?
Yeah, you know, I do kind of like, you know, spooky things, fairy tales, ghost stories. But I think that that particular subject isn't so much of my particular interest, the religious revivalism, but it's something that if you're interested in the history of our area, it's hard to escape. You know, it's just so ingrained in our history. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of time to read for pleasure? Because I know you're out seeing shows, you're covering things for City. How much actual time do you have to sit and read a book for pleasure?
You know, every single year my goal is to up the number. I used to be the most voracious reader. And one of the reasons that I picked this book, to be completely candid, is the only one that I finished all the way through. And it was that engaging that I read it within a couple of days. And I began reading it chapter by chapter with a friend that we just were like hanging out and cooking and taking turns reading. And it's really fun to also see a book through somebody else's eyes in that way the second time that you're reading it. And that like the reveals throughout the story. But yeah, it's I don't have a lot of time, but I do try. But sometimes my attention's kind of split between this book and I'll pick up that book and set one down. And yeah, but this one really caught me.
Yeah,
all the way through. Yeah,
that's great. Anything else you think our listeners need to know or should know about it?
So I was saying there's like some slow reveals going on in the book, but over time it moves from being really one of the wackiest, strangest ghost stories I've ever read to, and really starting out very bleak, to becoming this very solid, beautiful story about love and intergenerational understanding, specifically with among women in a family. And it's something that I could have predicted happening because of the structure of the book. It goes, each chapter goes back and forth between Ruth, who is the teen that I was talking about in the beginning of the book. You're introduced to her youth when she's aging out of the system and trying to navigate figuring out what she's doing with her life. And then every other chapter is her niece in a more contemporary time. But even though it's structured like that, it took me almost till the end to just, it just smacks you in the face how beautiful the story is about the love of women within a family.
I was talking to a friend in the community the other day about, it was actually a conversation about improv, and she said, how do you do scenes about things that you don't know about? And the example she gave was, what if somebody asked you to do a scene about Star Wars? And I know nothing about Star Wars. And I said, well, I do know that Luke Skywalker is the son of Darth Vader, so I would probably make the scene about a father-son relationship. And when I think about that kind of technique, I suppose, and I think about relationships, like, isn't that what it all boils down to? Isn't it all about relationships in so many of these cases? So is that what you related to the most in this book?
Yeah, because in the beginning you have these two characters that are really at a loss, and they become each other's sibling. They're very, very attached to one another, but it's still not enough, and they're sort of adrift out in the world. And by the end, you realize that they've really found it in a beautiful way. And I'm not going to say any more about that.
But, don't reveal. <but yeah. laughs> Awesome. Repeat the title and the author for us, please.
It's Mr. Splitfoot by Samantha Hunt, and it was published in 2016, actually.
Rebecca Rafferty, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2019, and our next guest is the Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda. Pete Nabosny is here, reading for pleasure or for work with this particular book.
I'd say a combination of both. I certainly enjoyed it. It was pleasurable to read. But
you would have read this book even if it didn't really apply.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it certainly has influenced the way I think about the work we do in the community here.
All right. So what's the book?
The book is Winners Take All by Anand Giridharis. And it's about the way that it's a philanthropy and the extremely wealthy in our society have the way that they've approached social change, let's say, is often in their best interests financially, while they can also assume a certain veneer of improving the society around them.
So let's talk a little bit about this, because this is, to me, one of the most important books of the year. Most important books probably the last couple of years, and really one of the thought leaders that is helping change people's minds on something. Because forever, and understandably so, the idea of philanthropy is like, well, of course that's good. And mm-hmm. No one is sitting here saying that giving money to causes that help people in need is bad. But the first thing that comes to mind for me is, how many societal level problems have been solved by philanthropy? I think none, right?
Yeah, it's certainly hard to think of one. I think the part of the book that really struck me was how so much of philanthropy, which again is a good thing, I'm not against philanthropy by any means, sort of short circuits the democratic process in society. It doesn't necessarily empower the kind of everyday person to make decisions about the way we're going to solve social problems. that has a lot of really negative effects. And I think the book really lays out how a lot of dissatisfaction with institutions and with the leaders in our society is at least somewhat contributed to by the fact that, you know, elites through philanthropy, through these kind of convenings like Davos and Aspen and places like that, they're not really responsive to the needs, desires, and of people, and they're not accountable to those democratic institutions, and that's really corrosive over the long run for the functioning of civil society.
Anand has been asked if he supports philanthropy in any form, and he says yes, when someone can be a traitor to their class. Mm-hmm. How would you define traitor to your class, Pete?
Well, I'd say I wouldn't use quite those same terms, but
but the author might describe it.
Sure, I think the way that maybe he lays it out in the book, the way I think about it, I guess, is the purpose of that person's philanthropy to change some of the structural realities of society today. You know, it's one thing if you're using philanthropy to somewhat like placate problems or to put a veneer on something that doesn't actually address core issues. And it's another if the way that you're using your philanthropic dollars, that your ability to fund different things is about changing some of the structural realities of life and society today.
The book has a lot of different examples to support his case, but those examples post-publication keep coming out month after month. And one recent example was the billionaire Robert Smith, who this year gave enough money to cover the cost of college and the loan debt for 400 black scholars, mm-hmm. graduates of a historically black college. And people said, well, this is great. But Anand points out, well, this is a guy who is creating tax loopholes and using everything he can and fighting any legislation that would get him to pay his full tax load. So what I wanted to ask you is, do you accept the framework that if we just would get these people who are giving money philanthropically to forget about that part and just actually pay their taxes, we could get a lot more done? Because the naysayers say, no, government's wasteful. Government's not going to solve those problems either. How do you feel about that part of the debate?
Well, I certainly think that, I largely agree. I agree with that point. I think that the sort of things like those showy, splashy donations, which again, it's great for those students who receive that debt relief and no one I think would say that's harmful, except insofar as it doesn't provide a mechanism to do that across all of the colleges and universities in our country, and having more government revenue can contribute to the ability of more people to be able to afford college, for parents to be able to afford childcare, for people to have the healthcare coverage that they need and deserve, and to be able to get those kinds of services. And so, you know, I think a lot of times those splashy displays are, they're really band-aids on a much larger problem, and it doesn't address the fundamental realities of people who are struggling in America today.
And so let's close with this. He kind of points to this idea of pushing the plutocrats, the plutes as he calls them, mm-hmm. to do something that they don't want to do, which is pay higher taxes, to give up more of a share of their massive wealth. And that this is going to be one of the great political and sort of social fights in the next election cycle and, you know, maybe for the next several election cycles. And it will define where we want to go as a society. Do you agree?
I agree largely. I think I certainly think he lays out a compelling case around certainly inequality in society. I kind of interpret it, and I think I'm this is me reading into it a bit more. So much of it's about power, and it's about the willingness of people with greater resources to give up some of that power that they have. And that power is often in the form of money. And so that's where I think the inequality piece comes in. But so much else is how through social networks and their connections to one another and, elite institutions and to some extent, you know, elected officials, they're able to sort of unduly influence decision making and the sort of direction of society. And I think some of that plays itself out in terms of you know, the tax burden that they face. And then some of it is a kind of a broader way that they preserve their own privilege and place in society, you know, at the expense of people, normal everyday people who, you know, who work and live in communities all across the country, being able to express their will. And so a lot of it is about using their financial resources to maintain a undue level of power. And I think that's just as corrosive as the sort of massive income inequality that that they also, you know, benefit from.
The man wrote a great book, and he's got great hair, doesn't he?
He sure does. I wish I could pull that off.
His hair is ridiculous. The book is called Winners Take All. Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. Happy New Year. We'll talk to you in 2020.
Thanks so much.
We are closing our annual Rochester's Favorite Books program this year with a book that was unexpected for both Evan and myself, definitely unexpected for myself, and it comes with a little bit of a story behind it. The reader that we have in studio is Jeremy Chung. He's a local activist and troublemaker, and well, a reluctant reader, Jeremy, you've described yourself as.
Correct.
And I'd like to share with you listeners the communication that Jeremy and I had about this process before he came in studio. So you're about to hear our dramatic readings of our email exchange. Here's mine. Hey, Jeremy. Evan and I are in the process of recording interviews for our upcoming end-of-the-year special on Rochester's Favorite Books 2019. We'd love to have you come in and tell us about your favorite read of 2019. Interested? Thanks, Megan. And then Jeremy replied in this way.
Megan, it's sweet that you think I'm classy and interesting and actually read books. I listen to Connections so I can sound smart and so that I don't have to read books. I do, however, love to buy books to support authors and causes, but their spines sit largely uncracked. Last month, I did find an amazing book at Rochester Greenovation called Monkeys on the Care and Keeping of Pet Monkeys. If this picture book fits within your year-end radio feature, I'd be glad to oblige with a chat about pet monkeys. All the best, Jeremy.
How could I say no to a chat about pet monkeys? That's question number one. But in your email, you also sent some pictures from the book, some scans of the book, with a woman holding a pet monkey. And I see you're flipping through it right now.
Oh, I brought the book with me. It's a picture book, which works very well on the radio.
Yes.
So I'll do my best to paint a picture with my words. And it's really about, it breaks down the different kinds of monkeys that are available. This was written in the, what year was this? Let's say 1961.
It looks like a library book, actually.
It's a library book. Yeah. It has a little thing on it from the Morrow Eagle Library Edition.
Okay.
And it's got a stamp on the inside cover. It says, Mrs. Weimer. Thank you, Mrs. Weimer, for donating your book to Rochester Green Innovation. Oh, it's 1955.
So pet monkeys must have been pretty popular in 1955 if a picture book on the care of them was issued.
At least possible. And I know that there are now laws. I think that's probably why there are now laws about the keeping of pet monkeys in municipalities. I know that I don't think in Monroe County you can have a monkey, but you can have a monkey in Wayne County.
Oh.
In fact, I saw at the Pride Village this year, there was a woman with her pet monkey, and she lives in Wayne County. I've been a little obsessed with pet monkeys for a while.
So great find for you.
When this book appeared, it kind of jumped out off the shelf to me. Actually, my niece, who brought me to Greenovation for the first time like 5 years ago, pointed out the book, and so it's due to her Hawkeye that I now have this book. And it tells you about like macaques and spider monkeys and the different breeds that you can have. And the like questions, important questions you need to ask, like, does my family want a monkey as much as I do?
That's true.
Because you don't want to be doing all the monkey work.
No, you don't want to be cleaning up after the monkey by yourself.
That's what they call monkey business.
Oh! Oh, boy.
Actually, the first time I actually encountered a monkey, can I tell a monkey story?
Please do.
Okay, so I was on vacation. This is like 15, 20 years ago. On vacation in the Cape Verde Islands, which is kind of wonderful, staying in like a hut on the beach. And every morning, the monkeys would come down from the jungle and play on the beach when the sunrise rose. And there was one little slow monkey, and he was like sweet and slower than the rest, and they kind of picked on him. He was like the bottom of the pecking order monkey. I was so he wasn't as fast as the rest. So he would arrive the last, and he would also leave the last. So he would, like, linger on the beach. And I would come down, and we would sit on a log together and just stare at each other. And every day I would move a little closer on the log until he would, like, be going through my hair looking for bugs. And he'd put his little paw on my leg, and we would just sit out and watch the ocean. How can you not want your own monkey after you've actually, and he was probably filthy and riddled with diseases, but, you know, I'm still alive.
You are here, and your scalp is clean. Thanks to your friend the monkey.
Well, I have cats now that take care of me.
Oh, okay.
Well, the whole reason that I wanted to get a monkey lately is because I have two cats.
Celino and Barnes.
Thank you for remembering.
I remember.
and they need a little, I need a little help taking care of them. So if I could get a monkey to, like, clean the cat box and brush them and, like, pick up the little tumbleweeds of cat fur in the corner, I think everybody's life would be better. So I've wanted a monkey for a while, and I've been a little obsessed with getting a pet monkey.
Well, I have to say, describing yourself as an avid non-reader or reluctant reader, I'm impressed that you've read this book. What have you learned? What was the most significant thing you've learned from, and this book is called Monkeys by, I can't see
by,
the author.
Herbert S. Zim, and it's from the William Morrow and Company.
Great. So what have you learned from monkeys? What's takeaway number one for you, Jeremy?
Takeaway number one is that if I were a member of the previous generation, I could have just, like, gone and gotten a monkey, and it would have been so easy. And I don't understand why, if it was possible, more people didn't have monkeys. Because it seems to me that they were missing out on a lot of fun.
If you were to write one book, Jeremy, based on all of your experience in, you moved to New York City to pursue a career in fashion and retail, you came back to Rochester to pursue activism work, you've had many different experiences. If you were to write the story of Jeremy Chung, what would that be?
I kind of think about my Instagram feed as like a document of my life, which is basically cats and snarky political posts and snaps of things that I happen to be watching on TV and drag names. So maybe my book would be like drag name of the day, and it would be like one. Maybe it would be both a book and maybe one of those like tearaway calendars that you buy at Barnes and Noble as a gift, and you have a drag name of the day. The drag name I'm obsessed with lately is Big Pharma. I think Big Pharma needs to be performing here in the Rochester area, and she doesn't need to be big. In fact, I think if Big Pharma was really really tiny, it would work even better.
If you write that book, will you come back in 2020 and discuss it?
Oh, sure.
Okay, we're waiting for that book now.
Clearly, I will come
no
back
pressure.
At the drop of a dime.
Well, thank you, Jeremy, for coming in and sharing Monkeys with us by Herbert S. Zim. I don't know how easy it might be to find this, listeners, but...
I'll give you the ISBN. I mean, this may actually be... What's the ISBN? It's from the Greece Public Library.
Oh.
And the Library of Congress catalog number is 55-6744 for all you librarian friends.
Jeremy Chung, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I hope you like that one of it. I had fun recording that
it's
with
Jeremy.
It's
hard to follow Jeremy Chung, to be honest with you. It's hard to follow Jeremy, who is one of the really great guys in Rochester, but that was a really, really funny email. I'm glad you guys had a chance to sit down and share that.
Well, Jeremy's also a Rochester 10, named a Rochester 10 by City Newspaper recently, so being recognized for his work in the community in other ways. He doesn't just read picture books about monkeys, so congratulations to Jeremy.
So we will attempt to follow that by, well, I'll ask you, your favorite book of 2019.
I'm going to choose Edie Windsor's memoir, A Wild and Precious Life. Edie Windsor is a gay rights activist and national icon. We did a whole show on her with her surviving spouse. It was a powerful hour. We learned about Edie's work in the civil rights movement, especially for LGBTQ rights, her Supreme Court case, which led the way to same-sex marriage equality in this country. But what I really loved about the book is how open she was about her personal struggles and just how her viewpoint about being open about her sexual identity changed over the course of her lifetime.
What's the name of the book?
It is called A Wild and Precious Life by Edie Windsor.
Okay. Well, the book I'll choose is by Chris Arnotti, who used to work on Wall Street. He grew disillusioned after the Wall Street bailout. He felt he was culpable for some of the problems. He felt sort of dirty, taking his firm taking bailout money, and he wanted to get to know the communities that he was always told as a wealthy guy you can't go. And he started walking in these communities, and he started meeting people and getting to know people's experience in poverty. His book is called Dignity, and it profiles people in some of the harshest circumstances of poverty in our country, people whose stories are often forgotten or, frankly, never heard in the first place. And I think it's maybe the most important book written in 2019 or published in 2019. It's called Dignity by Chris Arnotti. Hope you've appreciated these 2 hours. Great stuff. And we are very much appreciative of that. Who do we have to thank, Megan May?
We need to thank Rob Braden, our engineer, for his excellent work every day on the program, our intern, Emma Ray Stein, our team of volunteers that we don't thank nearly enough, Bob, Christine, Don, Dolores, Josephine, Tim, and David. Thank you all for your work throughout the year. Our entire team here at WXXI.
And I'll thank Megan Mack, the best producer this side of anywhere in public radio. So that's Megan. I'm Evan.
Thank you, Evan, for your work every day.
And from both of us and from all of us at Connection, Happy New Year. Let's talk again real soon, maybe in 2020. What do you think?
Sounds good to me.
All right.
We'll see you then.